Hello, Bill.
Good morning, Matt.
Welcome to the DMZ, everyone. It's 70 degrees here in Washington, D.C., and I'm told tomorrow the wind chill will be zero.
Well, it's not quite 70 in northern DMZ. It's more like upper 30s right now, but we're going to get below zero wind chill tomorrow and some snow, apparently. But we had a very nice day yesterday. So we're in this. I feel March is always like this, though, where like spring breaks out a little bit. And then it pulls back and everyone goes, oh my God, it's snowing in April. And like, I mean, at least where we are, there's only that one last burst of winter after the spring tease. Everyone gets all panicky. But I feel that's the transition from winter to spring.
I'm a warm weather person, Bill, and I am much happier when it's nice out. My wife tells me that she can notice a discernible difference, that I'm much more cheery when the weather is nice. But they say that it doesn't last. Like, they say that if you move to Hawaii, for the first 6 months, your happiness will increase. And then, after about 6 months, you'll return to your normal levels. And I do think that, you have to, what's the line? It's not till you've been in a valley that you can appreciate the mountains, the heights of a mountain. And so I think that maybe going through these winters makes us appreciate the springtime all the more.
Well, the one advantage to this, awkward stage is, I believe I've mentioned a recent show, it is Sugar Shack season here in Western Massachusetts. I think the sap is just about starting to flow. But we have about a dozen Sugar Shacks where they're open just for this six-week period, open on the weekends, serving pancakes and fresh maple syrup straight from the tree. And
what is a Sugar Shack specifically?
I mean, basically, you have these very small, maple operations. You know, they only sell locally, and they don't have restaurants that are open year round. These are people that have other jobs or own other small businesses, and so the mapling season is only in the time when the weather is above around 40 during the day and below freezing at night. It's that that fluctuation that loosens the sap. So you have this very small window for the sap to flow. And so to promote the product, these folks have little no frills pancake restaurants and very minimalist log cabin type things that are only just for the weekend. Just for 6 weeks.
What are they? What these facilities? What do they do when it's not Sugar Shack season?
I mean, the facilities themselves do nothing.
They just sit empty.
What's that?
Are they empty when it's not Sugar Shack season?
These are very minimal structures that don't really do anything else in the off season. But the people who might have other kinds of landscaping or construction, other types of things they do on the side that and the Sugar Shack thing is really just a side business. And you can sell your maple year round. Some of these people might just sell their maple out of their kitchen. I've literally driven 20 minutes up the hill, knocked on a guy's door, gotten a gallon of maple syrup, and gone back home. There are people that do that, or they just might sell a handful of product to some of the local grocery stores here, or do a little bit of mail order. But the restaurant.
So the government regulations haven't cracked down on this entrepreneurism.
No, but there is great fear that global warming will put these folks out of business because as the winters get warmer, sort of the maple line moves north. If you don't have that period in the late winter, early spring, where you're over 40 and below freezing at night, if that's just not happening, you can't do the mapling. So there's that.
Well, based on the winter we've had here in D.C., the maple line may be moving south. It was pretty cool. My dad used to. I love these cool little local things. My dad used to hunt mushrooms, not hallucinogenic mushrooms, but where I'm from in Western Maryland, I don't know. It's like usually around this time of year, I think. there's like a month where you can go out and find wild mushrooms. And if you get the wrong ones, it will kill you. But right. If you know what you're doing. My dad was like, believe it or not, my dad was an avid outdoorsman. He could have just survived on the wild eating, like, you know, locusts and wild honey, essentially. And he would go get these mushrooms, and then he would, like, fry them up and put them in eggs and stuff. And they tasted nothing like, you know, the wild mushrooms are totally different from the kind of mushrooms you would buy at a store.
Right. I mean, they're
really good.
You know, my brother-in-law, he once, you know, saw a neighbor's tree. I mean, one of those mushrooms is called chicken of the woods. He spotted it, you know, on a tree and said, hey, can I just rip that off your tree? And he said, sure. You know, it's one of those things that, like, it can be, it's called chicken of the woods because it kind of tastes like chicken. It has a totally different, you know, consistency.
It's really rich. It's really good. If you fry it, you sort of batter it.
Yeah.
Well, and again, do not batter anything. Do not try this. Yeah, that's true. Do not try this at home because it could kill you if you don't know what you're doing.
Right.
But he knew what he was doing. He grew up on this stuff, and people would sell them. It was like a hot commodity. Like, people who were maybe too old to go out and find the mushrooms, because it's kind of hard to find them, believe it or not.
Right.
And you could sell them and make pretty decent money during a certain time of the year, engaging in the mushroom black market.
Well, that's right. Our local farmers markets, I do get to get some chicken of the wood from time to time without having to, you know, risk the death of my entire family. But outside of enjoying nature, it has been an interesting early week in politics. Just yesterday, we had both a unprecedented presidential media appearance and also a special congressional election, which some say is a bellwether and some say it's not a bellwether. Either of those things striking your fancy today?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's worth mentioning all of it. We'll start with the Florida special election. I think it would be a mistake to read too much into it. I think it would be a mistake to read nothing into it. So we have a seat, and I think it was Florida's 13th district. It had been held for many terms by a Republican. But it's also a district that Barack Obama won, I think, fairly handily. There was a really flawed Republican candidate named Jolly, who had been the district director there for the Republican congressman, but was essentially an obscure lobbyist living in D.C. who defeated Alex Sink, who was a really well-funded and pretty darn good candidate who had run for governor in Florida, had really high name ID. I think, again, it would be a mistake to read too much into it. I mean, special elections are special. They're weird. You could expect that the Democratic base turnout isn't as great, certainly. On the other hand, I think it may be a bit of a harbinger of things to come going into the midterms. And I think, in my opinion, it's a sign that Obamacare is very dangerous for Democrats. Alex Sink didn't even vote for Obamacare. Wasn't in Congress, but Sink seems to have been sunk by Obamacare.
Well, it's just the big question is, what is the role of Obamacare in this? I don't think it's not news that it's probably a good Republican midterm year special election or not. You just have a lot of Senate seats that are up where you have Democratic incumbents in right leaning areas. Or open seats that are currently held by Democrats in right leading states. So all things being equal, it's going to be a good Republican year. Whether that's good enough that they actually take over the Senate is more the question. And there's not enough of a wave really either way where you would think there would not be a huge wave, a huge backlash against Republicans for Democrats to have a House takeover and dislodge a lot of Republican incumbents. And that was only going to happen if they were going to, you know, be shitting on the government every 2 months between now and Election Day. And Clay Boehner's gotten them to pull back to the brink on that. So just the fact that a Republican wins, and my understanding is that, you know, I think Obama won the district, but it wasn't like a landslide Obama district. It's a swing district. It's Tampa.
I think Bush won the district in 2004. It was a swing district in a swing state. So that's certainly true. Right.
And this is a, race won by, you know, a 1.5 point margin. But the bigger question is, was Obamacare the factor that tipped the race? And that, I would imagine, is much more debatable. As you might recall, Matt, I made the argument in the Virginia governor's race just 4 months ago, where the Republican Ken Cuccinelli, you know, his sole message in the close was Obamacare, and all the outside groups were pushing Obamacare. And this is a pretty, Virginia is obviously a very purple state, and that was not sufficient to stop Terry McAuliffe. And even some polling suggested that McAuliffe's position on health care was a positive for him and not a negative. And that was in the biggest hysteria over the healthcare.gov at the time.
But I would argue, I mean, just to flash back then, right. I did and would argue that the reason the election was so close is because of Obamacare. That Cuccinelli closed the gap at the end, and had it not been for the government shutdown, I think Cuccinelli would have won on Obamacare.
I mean, I think the question here that is probably difficult to be answered, I don't know what kind of exit polling data we're going to get out of the special election in Florida. You know, are there voters who were otherwise of a Democratic profile that voted for Jolly on the basis of Obamacare? You know, if the electorate just simply was a lot older and whiter than maybe typical in a presidential election year, or just not as typical, you know, in the country writ large, you just had older, whiter voters who were generally anti-Obama, who were disproportionately represented in the turnout, then Obamacare itself is not a tipping point. It's just a question of turnout demographics. But if they lost otherwise normal Democratic votes or Democratic leaner votes over the issue, then you'd have a case. I just don't know if we have that data to make that case.
Yeah, we probably don't. I do know that when they first started pulling this race, like in November, Sink was up by double digits.
That was when Jolly had no name ID at all. You know, Sink had been a statewide candidate before. So, it is obviously notable that Sink was up by a few points in the late polls. And apparently won the vote of those who voted on the day of election, but the Republican actually won the early balloting, which is a reversal from what's been happening nationally in recent elections. Democrats have had the stronger GOTV early vote operations, and Republicans were playing more of a voter suppression game and sort of dismissing early voting and trying to blunt it. To me, that's potentially the bigger story here. The Republicans have gotten religion on early voting, and are giving up the voter suppression game. I don't know enough to know that that's truly the case. But
I think Sink won the like absentee balloting, but it was overcome by the election day get out the vote effort. I think that's true, but. Look, if we're saying like deal, big deal, or no deal, I say just deal. It's something. I think it's if I'm a Democrat, it's a warning sign about what to expect in 2014. But probably a mistake to overplay.
Let's see if we just take the argument that it was Obamacare. You know, people are upset with how Obamacare's been implemented. It's like obviously it's not really the website at this point. But, you know, you keep your plan, or plans are available to me, and what kind of coverage am I going to get, all that kind of stuff, that is bothering people. And like I hear anecdotes of people just casually with uncertainties about what coverage I'm going to get, or I try to get into this plan, they didn't have a wide range of doctors, and these doctors aren't participating. You know, so there's definitely pockets of that stuff going out there, but you also have situations like in Michigan where the Koch operation, Americans for Prosperity, held up this one woman saying, you know, Obamacare is going to kill me. I'm a cancer patient, and they're making my claim totally unaffordable. A little digging occurred and found out she's actually saving money on the plan. So my point is that if there's a lot of uncertainty today in March, you just don't know if that translates how people feel about it in November, because people are going to, you know, the enrollment period for this year ends at the end of March. Certain amount of uncertainties in the transition will get resolved before November. It's only
but don't gonna... you think, okay, but here's, I think, an underplayed story, Bill. As you mentioned, the enrollment period ends in March.
Right, for this
year. And enrollment hasn't been that high, so there will be people who are locked out until the next enrollment period. So there will be people who, unless, I think, you know, if you have an extenuating circumstance, like you give birth or something, there are some loopholes that would allow you. But by and large, there will probably be a lot of people who try to get health care in May who find out that because of Obamacare, they're locked out until the next enrollment period. Like,
well, I think in all these cases, you need a I'm not speaking knowledgeably right now, but I would assume if it's like other type of insurance, if you have a what they call it, an event, a certain kind of event, you know, you change a job or whatever.
There are some loopholes, but
right. That's pretty standard for all insurance. So I would imagine there's not too many people who really wanted it, didn't get around to it, don't have an event of that nature. I would imagine that population is probably pretty small.
I would disagree. I mean, look, you're right. You have to have the enrollment periods because otherwise people would just pay the penalty, which is nominal, wait till they get sick and then sign up. So there has to be, you know, there has to be the sort of enrollment periods to sort of force people to sign up, to incentivize signing up. But having said that, I suspect that there are going to be a lot of people who aren't even aware that they have to sign up by March 31st or whenever the deadline is. And they're going to be stunned to find out that they can't get health insurance.
Well, this
they
segues
thought that Obamacare
into,
meant they could.
This segues into the other big issue of the week, which is Obama's appearance on the Funny or Die show Between Two Ferns. I can't pronounce his last name. I always forget. I'm
Zach Galifianakis.
Thank you, representative of the Youth of America. So, you know, he's been doing this show in front of your die, I think since at least since 2008. But it's sort of irregular. It's sort of whenever he gets a celebrity to do it. It is premised on it being, you know, a painfully socially awkward interview, where, you know, both the celebrities get taken down a peg, and Zach is sort of the butt of the joke as the dimwit interviewer, and so Obama going on this week was a way, you know, it's all about how do we get the information about signing up at healthcare.gov to, you know, the under 30 crowd who are the type of younger, healthier, uninsured population that we need to enroll to spread out the risk pool, to keep premiums down, and this is a big population of the uninsured community, period. And this is, I think, a bit of a sleeper element to this. The fact is the individual mandate penalty is not that stiff. And this was a debate in the original legislation where the insurance lobby actually wanted a stiffer penalty to ensure you wouldn't just want to, you know, pay a few bucks and, you know, let it ride. And they didn't want to come across as being overly punitive, so they actually made that penalty a bit on the low side. You know, if there's not enough sign up, that really would be the main culprit of that, that it wasn't a sword dangling over your head that you do this now, you're going to pay $1,000. What do you do creatively to get people aware of it and to do it? Going on shows like this is seemingly a successful way to do it. From they're telling us that web traffic did spike yesterday after doing the appearance, but it seems like a lot of conservatives are playing the "it's undignified" card. He's demeaning the presidency by doing this. I don't know where, as you are representative of the Youth of America, I don't know which way you fall on this.
Well, I mean, I guess I could say I liked Zach Galifianakis in The Hangover, and I thought there were some funny parts. Like, for example, Obama said something about a third term would be about as successful as The Hangover 3 or something like that.
Right.
I thought it was sorely missing applause lines. So, like, I felt like it didn't really work. Now, maybe I'm in the minority. Like, I thought there were good jokes, but I don't, you know, the shtick is to pretend that it's, you know, that it's a serious interview. I'd have to go back. You know what I should do is go back and watch Ali G because, you know, Ali G would interview like Pat Buchanan or Newt Gingrich and, you know, pretend that it was a serious interview. And that worked for some reason.
Pat Buchanan and Newt Gingrich weren't in on the joke. They were being pranked.
Maybe that might be the missing ingredient, because I don't think Ali G had applause lines. But in my opinion, there was something missing. Like, the jokes were funny, but I don't feel like it worked on a comedic level. What did you think of that?
I just disagree. I mean, that's just obviously people disagree about what's funny and what's not all the time. I thought it was hilarious. I showed it to my wife. She thought it was hilarious. I thought
the jokes were funny. I just felt like it didn't jive. I don't know why.
Well, I think have you seen other episodes of it?
Actually, no. I'd never seen the show before.
That's the style of the show, that it's sort of filled with these stilted, awkward pauses and has this kind of odd rhythm to it. That's just kind of, there's plenty of kind of discomfort humor that is not my thing because I am old.
Right. The Office would, you know, play on that sort of discomfort thing all the time with Michael Scott saying something inappropriate and just like a quiet pause, you know,
And there's a bit of a comedic trend in doing stuff like that. You know, I think one of the more recent ones that Zach did was with Justin Bieber, which I thought just rhythmically was very similar to what this one was. And so and that's why I think a lot of, you know, older conservatives, not that I'm lumping you in that category, look at it and are just sort of like befuddled by it. Because it's not Sid Caesar, you know, it's a different kind of comedic approach. And if you weren't, and that's sort of why I think it works, because if you get the joke going in, I think if you just saw and never saw past episodes, it would just seem kind of weird. If you sort of knew the concept going in, you're kind of like, I can't believe Obama's doing this. This is awesome.
That makes sense.
There's a tweet by David Gergen saying, you know, presidents shouldn't go on shows like this. There's a better way to reach young people. I'm like, well, you don't know anyone reaching young people. You have no experience in this. The whole point is that you're not supposed to get it. If you got the joke, it wouldn't work. The whole point is that there's this community of young people who feel like they're in on the joke, and that's why they're impressed by it.
No, that's a valid point. I do think that the obvious problem for Obama is when you do things like this, and it's not just the Funny or Die thing, but it's like when you go on The Tonight Show, when you go on ESPN and do your March Madness picks or whatever, fill out your brackets. Within the context of a bad economy, Russia invading Crimea, you can always say that is this appropriate when people are hurting, when the economy's suffering? He's playing golf and hanging out with Zach Galifianakis. I mean, that's always what the other side's going to say. Now, does it matter? Does it, you know, I don't know that really resonates, but that's the predictable attack.
Yeah, and I feel it generally does it. I think there are times on the left when we said that about George Bush, you know, and, you know, Bush should go on vacation so much kind of stuff. That didn't get us very far either. I think the one time where I thought Bush got into trouble was when he made that joke about finding WMD at one of the White House correspondence dinners. And people were like, you really didn't find WMD. It's really horrible what you did.
Well, it's funny you mentioned that, Bill, because I had an idea that I think would be an equally bad joke, but maybe not. Christie spoke at CPAC, and I thought that what if he joked about the bridge thing? What if he had a line that would be like, and if you're looking for someone who can handle foreign policy, let me just say, if I'm in the White House, there's going to be some traffic problems in Tehran.
That would
probably not be a good joke.
I laughed at least.
Well, the question is, like, on one hand, you could argue it's funny. You could totally hear Christie saying it. And by joking about the bridge thing and sort of dismissing it, he could begin to, like, dismiss it as, a, you know, so far he's taken it very seriously, which is the opposite of what Obama does. Obama doesn't take scandals seriously. He dismisses them. And it's like, if he doesn't think it's a problem, then why should you? Christy has been from day one, not from day one, but from the day that he started admitting that mistakes were made. Literally, he said that. He has acted as if it was a very serious scandal and that he has to get to the bottom of it. And maybe, you know, in retrospect, maybe he should have, you know, dismissed it a little bit more, not taken it as seriously. And so joking about it in this context, I suspect they would have crucified him for doing it. And that it would have gone over about as well as Bush's WMD joke.
There are mitigating factors there that he was joking about it before the emails came out, and he had to drastically shift his tone to adjust to the fact that it was obviously more real a story that he was saying it was previously. And so if he reverted back to that tone, that might have had more blowback for him. But you know, as a general rule, I think people like their politicians to be entertaining in the TV era. You know, humor does have its landmines, and so you have to be careful what it is you are joking about. And this is where I think Obama's approach is interesting. You know, different people find different things funny. And Obama, I think, has been very adept at playing niches and adjusting his tone and his humor. You know, I think he does certain jokes in larger town halls that are much cornier, but he can adjust and go edgy when he's dealing with, you know, younger, hipper audiences. And this is actually something I noticed. If you watch the entirety of the C-SPAN First Lady series, which I highly recommend, you know, a lot of it does get into the type of public personas the various first ladies did. And you can see what Michelle Obama is doing, going to places like Jimmy Fallon, for example, or Ellen. I mean, is wildly different than what almost every first lady did before her. And it's not like she's the only modern first lady. I mean, obviously, Eleanor Roosevelt broke the mold in various ways, and Jackie Onassis broke the mold in various ways. You know, Lou Hoover broke the mold in various ways. I mean, there's all sorts of stories. Frances Cleveland was a media icon in her day. So I don't want to be too much like what's happening today is always unprecedented. But I think you do see that both Barack and Michelle are interesting in that they have taken a modern technique and seem to have mastered it very quickly. And Nixon, of course, you know, was a TV pioneer, and he did "Sock It to Me" on Laugh-In. So it's not like it's really unprecedented.
"Sock It to Me,"
right?
Now I got a couple quick things about that. One, Rick Perry was on Jimmy Kimmel last night. Did quite well. Check out the video; it was very funny, and I thought he was well received. It's a side of Rick Perry that I always knew, and that's why I was fooled and thought he would be a real contender. He has a very charming side that most of America did not see. I also think that the Christie line, there's going to be some traffic problems in Tehran, is too risky to try. I would not advise he do that. However, in a parallel world, I would love to have him do it and then to see how it played out. Because I think there's like a 20% chance it would work and be great, and an 80% chance that it would destroy him. And then lastly, the point I wanted to make is that I think that in politics, there's this, you know, wide range of things that work. We've seen Michelle Malkin use humor rarely, but very effectively in videos when she does it. Surprisingly good and surprisingly charismatic for people who don't like her. And some of those funny videos where she's like dancing like Michelle Obama and stuff. There is a wide range of emotions that can be displayed by politicians, right? There's anger and passion. There's humor. There's optimism and hope that you can try to express. Having gone to CPAC, it's very clear to me that Republicans are really good. The Republican crop right now it is really good at anger. And that's what the base wants. It was very sad to see, but the speeches, the way to get applause at CPAC is to be very, very angry, to show just that side. Outrage, anger, that will get you applause.
Now, was this different than other CPACs? I feel like this is sort of standard fare for CPAC.
I think it's probably standard fare, but, you know, Rubio, to me, was the only one who gave a really kind of inspirational, he can sort of hit that Reagan-esque thing, like America's a shining beacon of hope, sort of that worldview about American exceptionalism and a little bit of optimism and patriotism. But it is funny because even amongst conservatives, you know, there is this range of emotion that the different buttons you could push, right? You could push the patriotism button. You could push the optimism button and the hope button. I mean, conservatives aren't immune to that. But almost every other speaker went to anger and that pushed that emotion. And it almost without fail worked. I mean, I wasn't there on Saturday, but I was watching on TV and there's this radio host and columnist named Tammy Bruce, who I guess is like a former leftist lesbian who
that's her whole shtick.
Is now a very angry conservative. And it sells like hotcakes, Bill, not to overextend the Sugar Shack metaphor. Literally, if you are really pissed off and you say and you express that, you will do quite well. And the problem is I don't know how that translates. I mean, you know, I feel like the best politicians, Bill Clinton, Reagan, and even Obama, can do happy, optimistic, sunny, and angry moral indignation, righteous indignation. I think Reagan could do both really well, but I think most politicians can do one or the other. And so that's something I look at, you know, can they do both? And I wonder if we're not training this crop of Republican candidates to be really good at anger. And then when it comes to selling to a wholesale wider audience, can they inspire like hope and change? Si se puede, clearly did.
Well, it seems like, you know, we always look at CPAC as kind of a gauging of the temperature of the conservative movement and conservatism generally. But in fairness, I mean, it's not like CPAC is necessarily reflective of the Republican base, let alone, you know, the general electorate writ large. I mean, how many CPAC straw poll winners get the Republican nomination? Not very many. You know, Mitt Romney had a terrible CPAC in 2012, the whole severely conservative bit, but he still got the nomination at the end of the day. So, and John McCain was never a CPAC favorite. I don't know how many times he even went. But so, is it possible that even though, you know, Rubio, you know, didn't light up the room, and I believe Paul Ryan didn't light up the room, if he's in some, we don't know if he's considering running or not, you know, might these folks still have more staying power in the presidential marathon than, you know, I mean, well, I guess Rand Paul won the straw poll, and the Pauls have done very well in the straw polls in general, but Ron Paul never translated that into anything. Obviously, Rand has more of a shot, I think, at the nomination than Ron ever did. But can we take his CPAC appearance as evidence that he can go the distance?
Sounds like Rocky. I think Rand Paul's for real. I think some of the talk about him being a front runner is overwrought, but I also think he's legit because he's got two really important things going for him. One, he has the Ron Paul infrastructure. I mean, Ron Paul got 21% of the vote in 2012 in Iowa, doubled what he did in 2008. So he's got an infrastructure that has clearly shown that it's capable of growing lists of direct mail, all sorts of things, activists. So he inherits the Ron Paul infrastructure, but I also think he's a much better salesman of the Ron Paul philosophy. I mean, he's much shrewder, and he's trying to position his libertarianism in a much more nuanced, palatable fashion. We see it with foreign policy. And Bill, I was ahead of the curve this week. I came back from CPAC Thursday night and wrote this piece, How Ted Cruz is Trying to Outmaneuver Rand Paul, and in which I talk, among other things, about foreign policy. Cruz is presenting himself as being in the middle of the Paul McCain spectrum. And lo and behold, a couple days later, you know, Cruz goes on ABC's This Week and is somewhat critical of Rand Paul's foreign policy. So I was a few days ahead of the curve on that. But I think, to me, if you're looking for a narrative, if you're looking for a story to come out of CPAC, the Cruz-Paul split over foreign policy is going to be something that plays out. You know, I wrote a piece at The Week 6 or 7 months ago that pointed out that they're in the same division. And so they're going to be, you know, Cruz and Paul, Ted Cruz and Rand Paul may be buddy-buddy, but at some point, if they both run for president, they're going to try to destroy each other because they're competing for the same voters, the same donors, the same activists, the same volunteers. And it does seem like Cruz is going to try to position Rand Paul's more non-interventionist foreign policy as being outside the mainstream. And I think within the context of Russia's invasion of Crimea and other stories about Iran and whatnot, that this is something to keep an eye on.
You've done some good work, you know, sort of fleshing out the Cruz-Paul friction and rivalry that's going on here. I'm curious what you think about how Cruz did at CPAC. On one hand, he opened CPAC. I caught a part of his speech. I'd read that people thought it was flat, and he didn't fare that well in the straw poll. Rand Paul was far and away the winner. So at least within this slice of the party, it seems that Paul is still the big dog. But I also noticed that when Sarah Palin in the keynote at the end of the conference talked about putting Congress on cruise control, the crowd went wild. So how do you square that? Is there a sense that, you know, Cruz is the up and comer who is being more, I mean, in some ways, he is being more belligerent towards the Republican establishment and mocking them as being insufficient to the task of carrying the conservative banner. And he's also being more traditionally conservative on foreign policy. Rand seems to have this sort of longer history of being an irritant in the party side and a stronger sense of having a different ideological worldview that would shake up the party from its roots, and that seems to have more currency right now. When you look at any polling and the straw poll here, but I'm not in the mix the way you are. Maybe you have a different feel, like who's ascendant, who's on the decline, or if it's really just an equilibrium right now.
Well, I think Cruz is really sending mixed signals. I mean, I expected him to be elected. You know, I've talked about it before. My wife actually consulted on his race when he ran in Texas. She hasn't worked for him for quite a while now, but I thought he was going to be a little bit more of like a Marco Rubio conservative. And I think the first year or so, he really kind of captured the Tea Party zeitgeist and got really close to the sort of Rand Paul position, drones and whatnot. But it does seem like I've been reading through Ted Cruz's speeches on foreign policy, and it's really interesting because, you know, sound bites will lead you to believe that Cruz is just, you know, this populist Tea Party libertarian guy. But you know what? I'm going to try to put together a video montage of his speeches on foreign policy, and it's surprising, Bill. He talks about American exceptionalism. He talks about moral clarity. He talks about his father, you know, being escaping communism. It sounds very Rubio Reagan-esque, much more than you would think. And Cruz gave, you know, the CPAC speech, he had a sort of a bad time slot. It was the it kicked off CPAC. A lot of people weren't there yet. They hadn't made it out to National Harbor, godforsaken, across the bridge into Maryland. So Cruz didn't have a great spot, but he also spoke at this, also the same day, there was a shadow CPAC convention put on by Frank Gaffney, and I think others, and it was called America's National Security Action Summit. And Cruz gave an amazing speech on foreign policy, talking about moral clarity and America's place in this world. And it is surprising. I hate to use the word hawkish because it sounds pejorative. And it's not really fair to call him a neocon either, but there is a real contrast beginning to emerge between Cruz and Paul. And it's not just cheap one-liners. It's if Cruz is now given several foreign policy speeches where he speaks at length. So this is really interesting. Philip Klein at the Washington Examiner wrote that Ted Cruz could be a real threat to Rand Paul because, you know, if Chris Christie criticizes Rand Paul's foreign policy, it's easy to just dismiss Chris Christie as a rhino or, you know, whatever. But when Ted Cruz criticizes Rand Paul's non-interventionist foreign policy as quixotic or dovish, that becomes a serious threat to Rand Paul. The last point I want to make is something that you said, is that I think, and it's funny because I just had Jim Antle on my podcast and I misspoke. And I said that Sarah Palin is clearly on Team Rand. No, what I meant to say on my podcast and what I've written is that I think it's becoming very clear that Sarah Palin is on Team Cruz. And I would not be surprised if at some point Sarah Palin and Ted Cruz kind of team up. And if Palin criticizes Rand Paul for his foreign policy sometime between now and Iowa, that's a crazy prediction, but I would not be surprised if it happens.
Very interesting. Anything else out of CPAC you think has been missed by the press? Is there a sense, are there good ideas that conservatives are banding about that you think have some juice? Are there up and coming stars that made their mark on CPAC, folks that swung and missed? Did Christie swing and miss? Did he seem to get a good crowd response, but still pull very poorly in the straw poll? You know, what's the big news at CPAC that you think people should have as their takeaway?
Well, let me just say, you said the straw poll, and I should mention, you know, Cruz did come in second, a distant second to Paul, but he came in second. But there was another group called the Senate Conservatives Fund, which are Cruz allies. And I think they tried to undermine Rand Paul's victory by releasing their own straw poll moments before the CPAC straw poll was announced, showing that Cruz won their straw poll. So it is interesting, the jockeying that was taking place behind the scenes. I think that Christie did okay. It was sort of a safe speech. He certainly was well received. There was no boos. I mean, you know, everybody's afraid to come to CPAC. But if you look at Romney and McCain and Christie, people who show up there are usually greeted politely. I thought Christie played it a little bit safe. I'm not saying he should have used my traffic problems in Tehran line, but I think he could have. You know, Christie's theme was that, Christie's theme, in contrast to Cruz, was that Republicans need to win elections. You know, that ideological purity is fine, but you need to actually win elections. He just sort of threw that line out there and then moved on. It would have been nice if Christie had had a little bit of a sister soldier moment, if he had dwelled on that Republicans need to realize that winning elections is where it's at. And if he had sort of, it would have been fun to see maybe him scold Republicans a little bit for their ideological purity and for not worrying about winning elections. He just sort of threw that out there and moved on. I thought Christie played it a little bit too safe. I would have liked to have seen him do a little more lecturing. But frankly, I think maybe he's been chastened and he doesn't have the political capital to lecture anyone right now.
And any other kind of sleeper developments at the conference worth mentioning?
You know, I don't think so. I think it was a good conference. You know, I don't think there was any huge takeaways or any huge stories. I mean, there were the fun stories like Steve Stockman going to a hot tub party that was chronicled by Dave Weigel and Chris Moody. There's always this sort of like, you know, the Daily Caller's Betsy Rothstein did a look at sex in CPAC. Those are sort of evergreen stories that pop up every year. I did something a little different. You know, I went all day Thursday and I didn't take my computer and I didn't bring a battery, you know, I didn't bring like a recharge or a plug for my iPhone. So I basically, you know, you go to CPAC and people are there and they're looking at their computer or their iPhone all day. And I tried to resist that, to go around just observing what was happening and seizing the moment, and just trying to, you know, be in the moment. And I came away, I think, with a better sense of it, and frankly, much happier, less pressured and less stressed than I normally am when I go to those things. So I don't think there was a huge takeaway. I mean, I think the Cruz versus Rand story is a narrative you'll be watching for a long time. But otherwise, just a good time to see old friends and to hear some speeches.
All right. Should we leave it on that note, sir?
That's a good place to stop. Check us out on Twitter at DMZ Show, on Facebook DMZ Show. Enjoy the Sugar Shack, Bill. Always fun talking with you.
You too. Take care.
All right. And don't eat those mushrooms, people. Bad news. See you next week.
Bye-bye.